Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Exploring the Evolving Treatment Landscape for Inflammatory Bowel Disease. I am Dr. David Hudesman, co-director at the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at NYU Langone Health in New York.
I'm Dr. Jordan Axelrad, director of clinical and translational research at the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at NYU Langone Health in New York.
In this program, we'll delve into the long-term management of inflammatory bowel disease and examine the latest treatment options and strategies that can enhance patient outcomes. To discuss more of this, we're very happy to be joined by Dr. Douglas Wolf, a gastroenterology specialist in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you so much for joining us. Why don't we jump right in? So Dr. Wolf, why don't you tell us some of the major challenges you have now in managing your patients with inflammatory bowel disease?
I think the biggest challenges relate to the fact that inflammatory bowel disease, both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, are a heterogeneous group of conditions. And essentially, there are many different forms. And so for Crohn's disease, of course, you can have ileal Crohn's, colonic Crohn's, fistulizing Crohn's, extraintestinal manifestations, and similar challenges with UC. So there are many different forms, and we don't really have any solid tests to identify which treatment is going to work for an individual patient.
Yeah, no, it's a great point, and I'm sure we all have patients that come in with a friend or a family member that have had this type of disease or been on this treatment, and they've either done well or not. And really explaining that to them, that each their disease is personalized for them, and we really need to discuss that with them up front before we go into treatments.
So Dr. Wolf, can you maybe tell us about how the treatment landscape has changed, especially in recent years, and how that's influenced your way of approaching patient management and drug selection?
Well, just as David pointed out, we're really trying to individualize and personalize care for every patient. And so, what's right for one isn't necessarily right for the other. In the past, it was kind of one shoe fits all, and people got a form of mesalamine or another to start, and then prednisone, and then maybe an immunomodulator. But, in the last 10, 20 years, we've had an increasing a variety of biologics, which are, individually very beneficial, but we, again, don't know which one's going to work for whom. So I think we have many more choices, and as well as having more choices, I think we're learning how to use the options that we have even better. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I think, the one thing I always talk to my patients or try to pass along to them is whatever the treatment is, I think what we've seen, more so with the Crohn's data than the ulcerative colitis data, but I believe it holds true for both, is that we want to treat them early, right? So if we say you're a patient that's either not doing well now or set up for trouble down the road, we really want to initiate our biologic or small molecule treatment early. And if we initiate it early, since we don't have good predictors, it probably matters a lot less on what therapy we choose. And unfortunately, I think we see a lot of these patients 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road before they get on appropriate treatment. So Jordan, why don't you tell us a little bit about sort of your approach to treatment? Take
sure.
out the therapies first, but sort of what are your goals of therapy? What are you discussing with patients?
Sure. So for me, the first thing I do when I'm seeing a patient in the office is essentially assessing their background disease, right? You want to know what's their disease activity, what's their disease prognosis. We use many tools to help us evaluate that, some scoring mechanisms. Obviously, we want to know what their endoscopic activity looks like, and that incorporates into many of our scores. And they differ. So for patients who fit more of severe criteria in ulcerative colitis, I may be thinking about different drugs, maybe anti-TNF, infliximab in particular. For people who fit more moderate criteria, I may be thinking of different drugs, anti-integrins like vedolizumab or even ozanimod. And in Crohn's disease, same thing, very severe disease activity, very severe disease prognosis. I may be thinking more about anti-TNF therapies like infliximab. And for more moderate disease, I may be thinking about more of the IL-12, 23, and IL-23 drugs. such as risankizumab or ustekinumab. So I think taking on all those sort of considerations, the drug selection has changed.
Right. And then, Doug, what are you telling your patients on the goals of therapy? So you start them on a particular therapy. How are you monitoring them when you're saying you're happy with the response or not happy with the response to that therapy?
I think it's very important to follow all of these patients closely. And so I typically see patients back between 4 and 8 weeks, and they have rapid access to reach me so that I can get them in earlier if need be. But we want to see that the initial course of therapy, which we term induction therapy, is really working. And if it's not, then some of the time there's some other explanation that we need to understand and analyze. It could be that there's a stool infection, such as C. diff, that maybe wasn't identified or appreciated early. But the bottom line is that we need to individualize these treatments. And certainly with biologics, we sometimes need additional treatment. We sometimes need to use an immunomodulator if we hadn't initially. Sometimes it's dosing issues. And with the advanced therapies, I've seen them work just as fast as biologics, and at other times they can take more time. And these treatments that I mentioned are agents like ozanimod and upadacitinib. They may or may not take a little more time. And so at least I can see the patient, talk with them, reassure them that we have to give it a little more time and make sure that there's nothing else going on.
So, Doug, you mentioned ozanimod and upadacitinib. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about how you choose the right patient for those drugs and what are you sort of thinking about and evaluating?
So I think that they're both great choices. The advantage of ozanimod is that it is FDA approved for both bio-naive and bio-experienced patients. So you can simply have had a patient who perhaps failed on mesalamine and a steroid or something else, and move on to ozanimod and give that a try. And it's very effective. On the other hand, upadacitinib, which is another very effective treatment, is reserved for patients who have failed anti-TNF therapy in the past.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned nicely that really ozanimod, a lot of their data shows benefit in that bio-naive population. And I think when we're trying to select what therapy for what patient, is this the first-line therapy? And I know you had presented an abstract at last year's ACG looking at a post-hoc analysis of the True North trial, the True North being the phase 3 trial for ozanimod, looking at endoscopic severity. So maybe you could just comment on how does endoscopic severity affect you choosing therapy specifically with ozanimod, and if that matters at all.
Yeah. So I think one great feature that is well documented with ozanimod is that regardless of baseline disease activity, whether it's moderate or severe, and baseline endoscopic activity, whether it's moderate or severe, ozanimod efficacy is well demonstrated by significant reductions in calprotectin levels and other measures too. So it works well for both bio-naive and experienced patients, those in the moderate realm, and those in the severe disease activity realm too. So it covers a broad range of patients.
Yeah, I think what's important about what you mentioned is that this new class, these oral small molecules, they're oral. It's also, you know, this is a new area of how we can take care of patients without injectables, without infusions. And so this offers a unique opportunity for us to provide a mode of administration that we haven't had in recent years, which is also really important.
Yeah, and I think that's how I'm using it in my practice now, right? If I have somebody along that moderate to severe ulcerative colitis spectrum, on the more moderate end, bio-naive, I think that's where the strength of the ozanimod data is. Failure of one biologic, there's some good data there as well. Once you get to multiple biologic failures, I usually don't go to this as the next step. But I think that's really where it fits in nicely. And as you've shown, it's worked well whether they have Mayo 2 or Mayo 3. So meaning, you know, moderate inflammation on colonoscopy or ulceration as well. And then it's that discussion, as you're saying, Jordan, right? So efficacy, safety, and then, you know, is a patient traveling a lot? Is this, you know, do they have to come in for an infusion or injection? So having that oral option is important.
Yeah.
Why don't maybe just talk a little bit about safety of ozanimod and sort of your thoughts about the safety profile or anything that concerns you?
Yeah, there really isn't. I think it's a relatively safe agent in the context of the other agents we have to offer. There's some initial testing that is done, as with other agents, and it includes some cardiac monitoring that is done initially, but ozanimod doesn't cause any cardiac issue. It's just a matter of being sure that everything lines up. So just basically some blood work and the safety has ended up being very, very favorable. So I'm very comfortable offering it to an array of patients with ulcerative colitis.
Yeah, I think what's important to keep in mind with ozanimod is that the patients with cardiac conduction abnormalities, those are the ones that you have to be careful of. Check their baseline EKGs and make sure that they're candidates for therapy. Although in inflammatory bowel diseases, many of our patients are younger, they don't have as many cardiac comorbidities, so that's not as an issue. And then, of course, in pregnancy, where we don't have as much data using this agent in particular in women who become pregnant.
Yeah, and I think the only other thing I would add is that the lymphocyte count, maybe about half the patients will drop, but yep, that's expected, right? And it sort of plateaus after a couple months on treatment, right? And stays that way. And that drop in lymphocyte count, almost how we expect that with thiopurines, has not been associated with any severe infections or serious infections. So it's not something, it's something to be aware of, but not something to be nervous of.
Exactly. I'd like to add that we've actually published on that although there is some relative lymphopenia that occurs, it's not associated with any untoward events. So, you know, there still is a sufficient number of lymphocytes circulating despite, you know, the mechanism of action to, protect us. And so we should feel comfortable with that.
Yeah, so for our moderate ulcerative colitis, moderate severe, you know, the way I look at it, more on the moderate end, I think, Jordan, you were discussing, we have vedolizumab. Mm-hmm. I think ustekinumab is a good option, ozanimod, and we talk about this because of good efficacy with also a nice safety profile. So, Doug, what about upadacitinib? So one of the other new oral small molecules that recently FDA approved for moderate severe ulcerative colitis. Could you talk a little bit about that agent and how you're incorporating that into your practice?
So upadacitinib is a JAK inhibitor. And so because it's in that class, it has where one has to have failed an anti-TNF before utilizing it. But if the patient is ready for the next step after going through an anti-TNF, I think that upadacitinib is an excellent option for them. And similar to Zeposia, in a way, it can be an excellent alternative to biologic therapy. And both of these options can be used even in patients who failed one or two biologics. I've seen them work. It is a different mechanism. And you know, as with many other agents, when we try them as a second or third choice, they don't work quite as well as if we had used them as the first choice, or the data suggests that, but they still work. And so I think, again, that's where reassurance with our patients that it may take a little longer to work is appropriate. But again, getting back specifically to upadacitinib, it is an excellent choice with biologic with activity effectiveness similar to what we've seen in biologics.
So, you know, we already mentioned the side effect profile and some of the monitoring that has to occur before initiating ozanimod. Anything in particular you're doing with upadacitinib or the JAK inhibitor class more generally?
You know, and you may be able to address the specifics a little better, but basically there are just class cautions. There are, you know, patients who have cardiac disease and other cardiac morbidity, those are individuals that we would be more cautious about using upadacitinib. But for the vast majority of IBD patients, they don't fit in that category, and so it's an excellent option.
Yeah, I agree. Just similar to the ozanimod sort of risk profile, a lot of our patients don't have a lot of cardiac comorbidities. Some of the big ones with upadacitinib are sort of the risk of venous thromboembolism, you know, PE-DVT. Those have popped up in some of the postdoc analyses of use of tofacitinib, another JAK inhibitor, oral small molecule for moderate to severe ulcerative colitis, and also some of the infection risk that maybe there's some more zoster that the shingles that we're identifying as well. But again, our patients would be lower risk.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that data has come out, and I think many of us are very well aware now from a rheumatology study, right? These are older patients. And when we looked at this class in our ulcerative colitis patients, young and old, we haven't seen that. I think we still need longer term follow-up. So I think it's something to be aware of and discuss, but not a reason not to use a therapy. And I guess, Jordan, what's your experience been and what type of patients are you using upadacitinib in?
Yeah, so as Doug mentioned, you know, these are really reserved for patients who are anti-TNF refractory. So this is generally going to be a much sicker patient, more severe on that moderate to severe spectrum. And that's generally who we're using the drug in. You know, these are generally infliximab IV anti-TNF failures. And the benefit of a drug like upadacitinib, as with most oral small molecules, is that it also tells you whether it's going to work very quickly. So usually, if patients are going to respond to drug, they start to feel better pretty early on in the treatment during the induction period, which is really important. But for my utilization, really being reserved for more of that sick patient who's failed other biologics.
Yeah, and I guess just maybe one more comment on this. I agree completely where, again, you know, when I'm looking at the moderate to severe spectrum for ulcerative colitis, moderate is, in my mind, vedolizumab, ustekinumab, ozanimod, mm-hmm. and in the more severe, doesn't mean severe hospitalization, but on the more severe end of the spectrum, we're talking infliximab and upadacitinib. And, you know, I've seen, you know, very good results, right? And I think, as you said, there's been some nice post-hoc analyses showing within a couple of weeks, well over 60% of patients don't have any more rectal bleeding, right? And, you know, when we're talking about our goals of care, yes, we want the CalPro to drop, we want the CRP to drop, but we also the patients, we want them to feel better and feel better quickly. So I think those agents work very quickly.
Yeah, I think one of the sort of lingering questions that we're still encountering and learning from is how we can sequence some of these drugs, maybe vedolizumab, then ozanimod. You know, is that a patient, what do you think about that, moderate, that's failed a biologic? Is that someone you'd be thinking about a different agent in?
Yeah, I think so. Great question. And I still look at the severity when I'm approaching positioning or sequencing on what's the severity right now. And then I still like to go to what's worked in the past, because I think, as Doug said nicely, right, we don't have yet, and hopefully it's not too long, of very good predictors of response for our therapies. So if I know somebody's done well on vedolizumab for years and then lost response and unclear why that happened, I think ozanimod would be a good option in that patient, right? Similar mechanism, anti-trafficking. And why wouldn't that work? On the same note, if somebody's done well with an anti-TNF for a while, we can pivot them to another therapy, but you know they do respond to that drug class. And if they do develop antibodies, let's say, and lose response, it makes sense to going to that same class where we know something works. So it's nice that we have these options, but it brings up these important sequencing questions.
Yep. I do want to say that the immune system is very complicated, as you all know better than I, and it's difficult to predict what the right sequencing is. I do have a few patients who were primary failures with vedolizumab, and then went into remission on ozanimod. So it's hard to predict, but I think the bottom line is we don't have these true predictors of which one to select, and we're very fortunate that we have more and more class options to try in these difficult diseases.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And let's pivot to Crohn's disease, right? So we have ozanimod and upadacitinib as newer small molecules for ulcerative colitis. Crohn's disease, our newest agent, is risankizumab, a selective IL-23 inhibitor. So Doug, maybe if you could touch a little bit about sort of the data, how you're using it into your practice, and how you're incorporating it into your sequencing.
Yeah, I think that risankizumab is a great option when one needs a biologic for Crohn's disease. It is more selective than the IL-12/23 agents, and that may, lead to an advantage. I don't think we truly know at this point, but I know that this agent is very well tolerated, and the three IV infusions that are used to provide induction therapy are incredibly effective at providing a response and a remission by the end of induction. So I think that the IV induction and then sub-Q maintenance strategy that's been designed for this agent is an excellent one and a great option.
So Dave, maybe you could tell us how you're sort of choosing the right sequencing of therapies in Crohn's disease and how a moderate versus severe patient, you would manage them a bit differently.
Sure. So I think, first, just real quick, so risankizumab, I agree with everything that Doug showed. And if you look at the data, there's some nice efficacy data or difference between drug and placebo, which we haven't seen as much in other Crohn's patients. And as what Doug was alluding to earlier, too, is once you're first line versus second line versus third line, a lot of times we see that dip. But risankizumab there still has a persistent difference between drug and placebo when you go first line, second line, third line. So I do think it's a very effective agent. So now how do I position it? Along that moderate to severe spectrum, I think, in the more moderate, I've been using, before we had risankizumab, I've been using a lot more ustekinumab first line, and I'm starting to transition that more to risankizumab. I think, it hasn't been on the market for so long, so we need some more real-world experience. I need some more real-world experience, but I have been using that more in the first-line agent or in the uncomplicated Crohn's second-line as a second-line agent, I've seen efficacy. Still, if there's anything that concerns me in Crohn's, right, so significant amount of small bowel disease, really significant deep ileal ulceration, perianal disease, that's when I think you stick with anti-TNF. I'm still using a good amount of anti-TNF, first-line, second-line, third-line, mostly infliximab and adalimumab. So I do see risankizumab being used more and more in Crohn's, but anything that concerns me, I still lean on the anti-TNF.
So Doug, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you think about a patient who's refractory to ustekinumab. Is that someone that you may consider risankizumab after, or how are you evaluating that?
Yeah, good question. So, I have used risankizumab both in the bio-naive and the multi-biologic failure Crohn's population, including those who have apparently lost response to ustekinumab, and there has been benefit. So I think that's been seen in the clinical trials, and I've seen it in clinical practice too. So I think it is enough different from all the others that it is a go-to agent when you need it for what one might term as salvage or simply another option. It is effective.
Yeah, and maybe one last point. I think, Doug, you also brought up an interesting point about the comparison between ustekinumab and risankizumab, and I think we'll have some further head-to-head studies. Mm-hmm. We don't have them yet for IBD, but if you look at psoriasis, right, the selective IL-23 inhibitor did outperform ustekinumab, and there is some phase two data with a different IL-23 inhibitor, guselkumab, looking at ulcerative colitis, and maybe there was a trend toward better healing. So I think this is something that'll be interesting, where efficacy-wise, is there a difference or not? Still, we don't know, but I think this is another very safe agent, and we're comfortable with that.
Yeah, I think the class of IL-23 inhibitors is going to be a growing class in our field, as it's been in other immune-mediated disease states.
Right. So let's just pivot a little bit to something that's going to be impacting all of our practices, everybody's practice, and probably a little bit of a headache for us are biosimilars and biosimilar adalimumab and however many that are coming to market. So maybe just briefly, sort of your thoughts on biosimilars, anything concerns you about the use of them? For, you know, right now we have infliximab biosimilars and now we have adalimumab as well.
Yeah. So I think that biosimilars do add an option for treatment. It's not really, again, it's not a class alternative. If one hasn't benefited from the reference or originator agent, one's not likely going to benefit from the biosimilar. I think the reason they're out there and that the government has backed this so much is that the hope is that it'll bring biologic, anti-TNF prices and other agents as they come out down. And whether this is actually true or not, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know whether it reduces cost for patients, but, you know, is a consideration. I know that they don't have the same access system sometimes to provide free drug to indigent patients, or it's more challenging. But let's just say that it is an alternative, and insurance companies have basically mandated switches to biosimilars. I think that the challenge, the problem with infliximab that I've seen so far is that one year a patient is switched to one of the biosimilars, and then another year may be switched to another, and no facility, whether it's a hospital or our practice, can stock, you know, more than, you know, one or two of these agents. So what the challenge is that, you know, we've been in the past, we were able to really manage and monitor these patients very well in our infusion units. And now the challenge is that we're needing to farm them out to sites that can give the particular biosimilar agent. And I think that's, something that maybe wasn't anticipated, but is a challenge to all of our practices.
Yeah, the new learning curve, as well as you mentioned, Dave, with adalimumab biosimilars, is that there's going to be many new devices, right? So our patients are now, and our staff and our offices and us, we're going to have to be familiar with multiple different devices and how they should be utilized and stored. And so it's going to be a kind of a steep learning curve, especially since adalimumab is going to be able to be swapped out at the pharmacy. We may not know if patients are getting originator versus a biosimilar that their individual policy is covered by.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be important that we learn from each other on this, really how to incorporate this into our practice, because that's exactly my biggest concern. From the use of it, right, there's been multiple studies, infliximab, adalimumab, multiple different disease states. I'm not worried about efficacy or safety or drug levels, antibodies, anything like that. It's just, how do you use it in the practice, and how is a patient aware? And we've learned from this, right, Jordan, that when we used infliximab, sometimes the patient came to an infusion center and they found that day they were getting the biosimilar before they heard from us, right, when it first came out, and that's not the way you want to do that, right? There's a lot of concern and anxiety, and I think the key there is going to be education, having the staff being able to communicate with the patients, letting them know ahead of time, and what's the right workflow to figure that out. And for me, that's the biggest concern with that. So I think we've had a great discussion here about how we're positioning therapy, how we're sequencing therapy, how we're incorporating some of our newer agents. And maybe we could just go around and just ask each one of you your sort of what you're most excited about, whether it's newer therapies, whether it's different uses of our current therapies in the next couple of years. So Doug, let's start with you.
So, I think there are two areas. One is whether monotherapy with anti-TNF and infliximab is best, or whether it's a combination therapy. And you know, I'm in the camp that I use monotherapy the most because I've seen the most complications, the severe ones, primarily lymphoma associated with combination therapy and an immunomodulator, especially 6-MP and azathioprine. So I think we're still, you know, perhaps sorting that that out. And then the other topic is combination biologics. And I've been involved in a couple of clinical trials where we have used them with efficacy and with safety. And so that may be the safer, the better way to add on a second agent in the moderate or perhaps severe disease activity category and or disease severity category, where you're really needing the best combination for your patients. And the challenge there is getting an insurer to pay for it. So we have been successful selectively in being able to use it, but the majority of cases have resulted in denials. So I don't know how things have worked in your facility.
Yeah, I think, Doug, you already alluded to part of it, is some of these combo biologic studies. That's something that's very intriguing, especially for more of our sick, complicated patients. What we've learned from some of those studies, particularly in Crohn's disease, is that arms that included an IL-23 agent, even a monotherapy, was pretty effective. So I think what I really look forward to moving forward are better utilization of IL-23, different IL-23 agents, and how that class, you know, in and of itself may help our patients. But of course, combo therapy looks better. How that can be done is of course, a question.
Yeah, and I think most of the patients I have on it now, right, there's usually an EIM, right, an extraintestinal manifestation, and you have two different reasons to use it, and that's how we've been able to get it through. But otherwise, I think we're not quite there yet for prime time. Should we be using this up front? Should they fail one agent? Should they fail multiple agents? But as you said, and as you've been involved with, there's a lot of ongoing studies. So I think that's, you know, I agree completely that that is the most exciting part, as well as there's some newer agents coming to market and this concept of companion diagnostics. Mm-hmm. We don't really have the full data on that, but can we personalize therapy or at least give something? Well, hey, you're more likely to respond to this class, you know, if you test positive here. Again, not there yet, but there's some interesting early data on that. So again, want to thank everybody for their time. This was a great discussion. And I just want to end, you know, the last key point here is whatever agents we're choosing for our patients, let's start these therapies early. And if we start early, we usually tend to have the better results. Thank you so much, Doug. Great seeing you. Great speaking
with you,
Jordan.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Jordan. I appreciate this dialogue.